Welcome to SMT Pod, the premier audio publication of the Society for Music Theory. In this episode, Samantha Sasaki analyzes three bagpipe performances of Auld Lang Syne in Hong Kong in order to uncover why this instrument has retained cultural and political significance in the 27 years post-handover.
As Hong Kongers rang in 2024, the banks of Victoria Harbour sounded a bit like this. Under the roar of fireworks and the murmur of the celebrating crowd is the unmistakable strain of the song Auld Lang Syne on bagpipes. The Hong Kong Police Pipe Band, a pipes and drum subsidiary of the larger police band, play this song every year as part of the city's New Year's Eve celebration. There were a few things that intrigued me when I first saw this recording, but I couldn't stop thinking about the prominent use of bagpipes in this performance. While I could easily think of historical explanations for the bagpipes' relocation to Hong Kong, it is a former British colony with large numbers of Highland regiments stationed there under the colonial rule, I was intrigued as to why it remained a culturally significant musical instrument, in spite of the massive political changes that have occurred in Hong Kong since 1997. In this podcast, I explore the lasting musical, political, and cultural status of the Great Highland Bagpipe in contemporary Hong Kong. While ostensibly a symbol of British colonialism and military might, why has this instrument retained its prominence among the Hong Kong police, musicians, and pro-democracy protesters alike? How has bagpipe music been recontextualized over the 27 years since the handover from British to Chinese governance, and what impact, if any, has this recontextualization had on musicians and listeners alike? Is there an underlying reason, a general impulse, that explains the continuity and change in Hong Kong bagpipe music? To start addressing these questions, I examine three performances of Auld Lang Syne on bagpipes in Hong Kong from 1997 to 2024 in order to identify what impulse, if any, undergirds this period. One thing that is crucial to acknowledge is that Hong Kong is not unique as a formerly colonized region to retain a musical and cultural connection to the Great Highland Bagpipe. India, for example, modeled its military after the British Army and has Highland regiments. Up until last year, pipers played a significant role in ceremonial events and state dinners, akin to their role in the United Kingdom. In addition to having several military pipe bands, South Africa has a vibrant civilian piping community. However, what makes Hong Kong a particularly fruitful case is the fact that Hong Kong bagpipe music is actively being politically contested. In the years since the passage of the National Security Law, which many critics called the end of the one country, two systems in Hong Kong, the government has increased its decolonization efforts in the cultural sphere. Hong Kong police have begun to replace the traditional tartan kilts and trews with more traditional brass uniforms, remove many of the traditional Scottish folk tunes from their repertoire, and move towards using the People's Liberation Army's foot drills during parades and events. Questions of decolonization and national identity are at the heart of this evolving, sometimes conflicting status of the Great Highland Bagpipe. Before I dive into this analysis, I want to situate this case study within the larger project of global music theory and the challenges that this field faces. One crucial tension that underlies this field is how to contend with questions of difference and relationality. After delving into the difficulties and nuances of this tension, I propose a potential methodology for analyzing a truly global musical object, in this case, the bagpipe, that addresses the multiplicity of histories, meanings, and emotions associated with its music. Kofi Agawu lays out a convincing case against a global music practice oriented towards identifying differences between musical cultures in contesting difference, arguing that this approach invariably perpetuates a system of othering. Ethnomusicology in particular is built on constructing difference, as the knowledge of other musical cultures is always defined in relation to Western structures of knowledge. Crucially, Agawu argues that this difference-making is not simply a methodological issue that can be resolved by moving to a we model from an us versus them model, or by undercomplicating Western art music in order to laud another musical tradition. Both still rest on comparisons on the terms of European art music and inherently take Western art music to be the norm. This presumption of difference is a fundamental mindset for ethnomusicologists and one that we need to be aware of when thinking globally with music. It's easy to slip into this mindset when thinking about a musical object or tradition that moves between cultures, as it necessitates comparison. In this study, that comparison is between Scottish folk music and culture and Hong Kong contemporary culture. Comparison isn't inherently problematic. In fact, it's often incredibly illuminating. But when this comparison is the only method of analysis or relies on proximity to Western art music for legitimacy, it risks oversimplifying and essentializing cultures. Agawu instead argues for a presumption of sameness, a shift of one's worldview away from searching for and explaining difference. In this perspective, the researcher would, quote, unearth the impulses that motivate acts of performance and seek to interpret them in terms of broader, perhaps even generic, cultural impulses, end quote. By attending to sameness, one would be able to look beyond the material, not ignoring the material constraints and affordances, but instead focusing on how they translate larger and perhaps even global cultural impulses. Furthermore, this perspective is future-oriented, exploring how changes in material conditions and affordances can lead to musical and cultural shifts. In terms of relationality, this mindset shifts force us to think about societies in dialogue with each other, and more broadly about how human trends filter through specific conditions. Uncovering the general impulse that animates bagpipe music in Hong Kong would help us understand not just what the bagpipe symbolizes in a global context, but also why musicians around the world would gravitate towards these types of symbols. Agawu suggests in this chapter that there isn't a specific methodology for identifying these underlying widespread commonalities, instead contending that this is primarily a mindset shift, a major break from the difference-oriented ethnomusicologist perspective. There are several practical reasons for this. As Agawu acknowledges, it's easy to dismiss this reorientation as reactionary or essentialist. In establishing a methodology, Agawu risks pigeonholing his intentionally broad theory into a more easily contestable framework. However, it does, inevitably, raise the question of exactly how one can practically implement this theory in their global work. Agawu suggests that the general impulse is translated by material conditions, such as resources, bodily constraints, tools, and socio-political factors, to shape patterns of behavior. This progression makes logical sense and suggests that examining the miasma of material affordances is a fruitful place to locate the commonalities that point towards a general impulse and help identify which specific ones might animate musical behavior. However, the method through which to accomplish this is lacking, both in theory and in Agawu's application in The Minimalist Impulse, a chapter in his 2023 book on African music. In particular, there's little to no acknowledgement of the future orientation, the potential for change, which he underscores is crucial to not just avoid essentializing, but also to understanding the general impulse. One cannot find commonalities without examining these shifts. It is hard to ignore the resonance between Agawu's emphasis on the future-oriented nature of attending to sameness and Judith Becker's theory of a habitus of listening. Becker draws upon Pierre Bourdieu's theory of the habitus, which refers to how the social, cultural, political milieu surrounding different classes in mid-20th century France shaped their cultural tastes. While Becker did not replicate Bourdieu's thorough sociological survey to determine these distinctions, she draws upon his influential conclusions regarding the habitus. Becker argues that how one listens is inherently contextual and learned, deriving from a listener's positionality, encompassing their location, social class, political influence, lived experience, and cultural context. Like with Bourdieu, this habitus of listening is an embodied tendency or pattern of action, not necessitating an action, but rather providing a subconscious disposition towards a behavior. Since this habitus is learned, it is constantly evolving and changing as one moves throughout the world. Becker's work and her reliance on Bourdieu suggest that delving into the specific social, political, and locational elements of a person's habitus can help us understand musical behavior. In her chapter, Becker explores the religious, historical, philosophical, and social factors that establish different emotional responses to and engagements with music around the world. While her analysis clearly articulates the relationship between habitus and behavior, she, like Agawu, does not properly address how and why a habitus changes, simply saying that it does. To understand why bagpipe music remains integral to Hong Kong's musical, political, and social life, it is important to examine and acknowledge continuity and change on all levels. Furthermore, neither Becker nor Agawu fully acknowledges how recursive these concepts are. Becker suggests that one's habitus can adjust or be contested within something as local as a single performance, but does not take the next step to systematically examine how behavior opens up new material affordances or alters the socio-political conditions of possibility. What, then, is the relationship between these different concepts? In this model, the general impulse is the impetus behind the system. As Agawu suggests with his discussion of visual art minimalism, this impulse is likely found outside of the musical sphere as well as within it. This general impulse is then shaped by local material affordances such as resources, bodily constraints, systems of transmission and trade, location, and geography, translating this general inclination into more particular outcomes. Similarly, the social, cultural, historical, religious, and political miasma that shapes an individual's habitus of listening helps them situate themselves within musical experiences and locations, relate to them, and respond and react to them. It also seems clear that the habitus of listening and material conditions impact each other by shaping the conditions of possibility for each. The habitus can shape how instruments are used, what types of locations are most apt for performance based on religious or cultural guidelines. Material conditions may also impact the feasibility or actionability of political and identity-based ideologies. Finally, as Becker and Agawu suggest, musical behavior can similarly shift one's habitus and the material world around them. These elements are mutually constitutive and point to factors outside of the general impulse where relationality and difference come into play. Commonalities and change could arise in any of these areas, from impulse to behavior. However, this model provides a methodology that is specifically oriented towards identifying these commonalities in change over a historical period. Theoretically, the general impulse remains relatively stable over time as a larger disposition, meaning that changes in musical behavior would be generated by the habitus of listening, material affordances, or consequences of other behaviors. By examining these shifts over time and identifying what and why changes have occurred, one can identify what has remained consistent and look for what larger trend underpins that. In this project, I hope to uncover what general impulse accounts for these moments of commonality and of difference in Hong Kong. Since the relationships between these four concepts are recursive, there are many different avenues for exploration. In order to draw finer points of comparison and limit the amount of variables, I am examining three different bagpipe music performances of Auld Lang Syne, a traditional Scottish folk song, in Hong Kong from 1997 to 2024, the 27 years post-handover. The performances are the 1997 ceremony itself, a 2019 soft power tactic by police to remove protesters from Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and the 2024 New Year's Eve performance by the Hong Kong Police Pipe Band. In accordance with the methodology I have outlined, I examine how the habitus of listening and material affordances have evolved over these 27 years. Ultimately, in spite of the political changes that have engulfed Hong Kong, the bagpipes have continuously represented a desire for stability. Crucially, this impulse to create stability and solidarity in the midst of unrest has manifested in a multitude of ways, from representing an apolitical constant to forcing order by suppressing dissent. How did the bagpipe and Auld Lang Syne take root in Hong Kong? When we refer to the bagpipe, we primarily think of the Great Highland Bagpipe, which originated in Scotland sometime around or before the 15th century. While an organology of the Great Highland Bagpipe is outside the scope of this podcast, I want to briefly discuss the general construction and scale of this instrument. The bagpipe consists of an airbag, three drones, a chanter, a blowpipe, and five stalks. To play, the piper blows into the blowpipe to fill the airbag. A valve in the pipe prevents air from coming back out, so the piper can take their mouth off of the pipe to breathe while maintaining airflow in the bag with their arm. The drones are tuned to the same note, a tonic on the bagpipe scale, though the two tenor drones are an octave above the bass drone. The chanter is a conical pipe with nine finger holes, which the piper plays to create the melody. The stalks stabilize the bagpipe and keep it vertical during performance. Pipers consider the bagpipe scale to run from an A to an A, with an extra low G on the chanter. Musicologist Ewan McPherson argues that this often aligns with an A Mixolydian scale, as an A is played on the drones, though sheet music usually notates this in the key of D major. However, bagpipes use just intonation tuning and do not align with concert or orchestral tuning. To the listener, a low A sounds like a B-flat. This creates an intriguing disconnect between the performer and the audience, and even between performers, since the bagpipe player will be thinking of a different scale than the orchestral musicians are. There are some interesting performance and symbolic affordances inherent in the construction of the bagpipe, which seem to suggest a self-contained nature and emphasize a need for stability. For one, there is a popular misconception that pipers are constantly blowing into the blowpipe, which creates a perception that performance is extremely physically taxing. In reality, many pipers find the task of controlling airflow with the bagpipe arm to be the most challenging. An increase in pressure changes pitch, not volume, and maintaining pressure while breathing takes immense skill. This dialectic requires the performer to be incredibly stable in their performance. Additionally, the just intonation tuning means that the drones often sound discordant until the chanter is played, and the bagpipe itself can easily sound out of tune when played with equal-tempered instruments. The bagpipe, in and of itself, creates and reinforces its tuning and musicality. Finally, the drone or a chanter construction means that there is always a pedal grounding the melody. Bagpipes ultimately both require and perform stability. Auld Lang Syne is a traditional Scottish folk song, with lyrics penned by the famed Scottish poet Robert Burns. Burns's Auld Lang Syne wasn't the first version. A few other poets, most prominently Alan Ramsay, had written similar lyrics set to different and apparently more complex folk tunes throughout the 18th century. After its publication in George Thomson's Select Songs of Scotland in 1799, this song quickly became popular throughout Scotland, gaining a prominence akin to the unofficial anthem, Scots Wha Hae, and then across the English-speaking world. Today, it is sung at New Year's Eve celebrations around the world. The lyrics of the first verse are as follows. Should old acquaintance be forgot, and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot, and the days of Auld Lang Syne? For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll drink a cup of kindness yet, for the sake of Auld Lang Syne. The lyrics reflect on the nature of relationships over time, what may change and what may stay the same. It is at the same time hopeful and bittersweet, akin to how New Year's Eve feels. Musicologist M.J. Grant argues that this song promotes collective singing through its relatively simple melody, repetitive nature, and its universal sentiment. Even if you've never heard the song before, by the 10th iteration of the melody, you can likely hum along. Crucially, Grant points out that in spite of its wide recognition, its lyrics are often forgotten or incorrectly sung in casual performance. For Grant, this suggests that the emotional association linked to Auld Lang Syne exists independently of the lyrics. The tune itself evokes the nostalgia, hopefulness, and regret. While many different types of pipes exist, primarily originating from Europe, South and West Asia, and North Africa, the Great Highland Bagpipe is used worldwide, due in large part to its connection to British colonialism. The British Army included Highland regiments, so even though Scotland was never officially an occupying force in the British colonies, the Great Highland Bagpipe and Scottish folk music was imported to Hong Kong in the early 20th century. According to Anthony Ho, one of the first scholars to write about bagpipe music in Hong Kong, bagpipe music was fairly ubiquitous during the colonial period, as pipers performed during military parades and festivals, in addition to their daily job of calling soldiers to their duties. The first all-Hong Konger pipe band, the Pipes and Drums of the Royal Hong Kong Police, was established in 1954. This band, which was run by the colonial government, performed a myriad of public and private events, from graduation ceremonies to house parties to official government receptions to New Year's Eve celebrations. The popularity and success of this band sparked the creation of many other government-organized and privately-run pipe bands. Crucially, these bands, including the Police Pipe Band, adopted the marching styles, outfitting, and music of the Highland regiments. Andrew Yu, a piper and ethnomusicologist, argues that there was an intentional, targeted attempt by colonial pipers to promote piping among Hong Kongers in the mid-1960s as a form of social control. In 1967, a series of anti-government riots swept through Hong Kong, initially over a labor dispute in the Hong Kong artificial flower works factory that grew into large-scale protests, strikes, and eventually more violent unrest. These riots were deeply influenced by the simultaneous cultural revolution in China, and historian Stephen Tseng argues that a local branch of the Chinese Communist Party played a crucial role in organizing the protests. After quelling the unrest through political reform, the colonial government published a report called Kowloon Disturbances 1966, Report of Commission of Inquiry on the Anti-Government Disputes, advocating for the government to find ways to divert, quote, excess energy as one of the ways to prevent social unrest, end quote. Yu contends that this attitude led to the government-sponsored promotion of piping among Hong Kong youths. The Royal Hong Kong Police Pipe Band became involved with the privately run Scout Band, bringing in Scottish pipers for lessons, allowing the band to wear the police tartan, and establishing rehearsal space near one of the Highland Regiment's training grounds. In the years preceding the 1997 handover of Hong Kong from the United Kingdom to China, the Great Highland Bagpipe was invariably associated with symbols of British colonialism and attempts at social control. The relationship between militarization and the bagpipe was not just theoretical, but literal, as the music was either performed by the police and army, or by bands emulating their organization and style. At the same time, many pipers who grew up before the handover speak fondly of the bagpipe music they heard and played during this time. One piper interviewed by Anthony Ho lamented the decrease of bagpipe performances since the handover. Andrew Yu describes this music as, quote, a tool by the colonial power to comfort people, end quote. These accounts suggest that there was a significant ambivalence surrounding the status of Hong Kong and its relationship to its colonial past. Even in the midst of social and political unrest, the bagpipe was a symbol of stability for the colonial government and musicians alike, albeit a forced one for the former. With this social, political, and musical background in mind, I will now turn to my first case study, the performance of Auld Lang Syne at the 1997 handover ceremony. At midnight on July 1st, 1997, Hong Kong sovereignty was transferred from the United Kingdom to mainland China, marking the end of a 13-year transition from a British colony to a special administrative region in China. While the One Country, Two Systems framework established by the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration reportedly ensured that Hong Kong would retain much of its social, economic, and political autonomy until 2047, many were doubtful that it would hold. Political scientist Melanie Mannion saw that emigration from Hong Kong averaged 48,000 people a year from 1987 to 1997, around 17,000 more than the previous 10-year period. Polls conducted by the Hong Kong Transition Project in June 1997 showed an almost perfect divide between worried and not worried respondents. J. Lawrence Witzleben, an ethnomusicologist, argues that the ceremony both reflected this ambivalence while at the same time tried to construct a unified cultural and political image of what Hong Kong could be through musical performances and rituals. The bagpipes featured prominently into the evening ceremony. Right after the Union Jack and colonial Hong Kong flag were lowered, Pipe Sergeant Stephen Small played the song Immortal Memory on the bagpipes to signal the British troops' retreat. The last song of the handover ceremony, and relatedly, the first one to occur after Hong Kong was handed over, was Auld Lang Syne, which was performed by the Hong Kong Police's combined brass and pipe bands as the British Army exited the arena. The choice to make Auld Lang Syne the first song performed under Chinese governance may seem odd at first. Despite its global reach, the song is inextricably linked to British colonialism, and the bagpipe only serves to bolster this association. The outgoing colonial government organized the evening ceremony, which could indicate that this song was intentionally chosen to remind the global audience, including the new Hong Kong administration, that the region's connection to the United Kingdom would never truly go away. While I don't disagree that this was an impact of performing Auld Lang Syne, I would like to argue that it is a consequence of another phenomenon. Witsafan contends that the British organized ceremony emphasized internationalization and multiculturalism, attempting to imagine Hong Kong's future as one of global connectedness and harmony. He further argues that military bands, such as those that played Auld Lang Syne during the handover ceremony, were part of an international musical language. This perception of the ceremony suggests that the organizers intentionally avoided characterizing Hong Kong through national identity. In this perspective, Auld Lang Syne is an apt choice. For almost two centuries, Auld Lang Syne has been sung at New Year's, a holiday which seems, at least on its face, to be apolitical. Of course, the song's worldwide reach is due to the British Empire, and any effort to claim that this song is apolitical is politically charged. As a result, by positioning Auld Lang Syne as a politically neutral tune, the organizers attempted to reflect the audience's ambivalence towards Hong Kong's future under Chinese sovereignty, while at the same time aimed to make a type of solidarity through this shared experience. This goal of creating a unified Hong Kong and Auld Lang Syne's supposed neutrality masked the colonial underpinnings. This complicated relationship is also symbolized in the bagpipe itself, as it is both an unmistakable reminder of colonialism and an instrument with local and international significance. How might the socio-political context of the ceremony and the historical and emotional associations to Auld Lang Syne have shaped the audience's response? During the second refrain, the crowd begins singing along, though not on words. They don't sing the entire time, only for a few repetitions, but it is a crucial moment of participation in an otherwise formal ceremony. The crowd's participation in singing Auld Lang Syne indicates a level of familiarity with the tune, which is likely due to New Year's Eve performances. Regardless of each individual's specific feelings towards Hong Kong's future, for a few seconds, they came together in a shared musical experience that acknowledged this uncertainty. The bagpipe in Auld Lang Syne's symbolic ambiguity provided a type of stability for organizers and audience members alike. It validated and performed the complicated emotions surrounding the event. Furthermore, the attempt to position both as politically neutral provided another possibility. Perhaps in spite of the political uncertainty, bagpipe music would still be a constant in Hong Kong life. Let's now jump ahead to November 2019. During the height of another period of social and political unrest in Hong Kong, the anti-extradition bill protests of 2019 and 2020. On November 17th, student protesters occupied the Hong Kong Polytechnic University and blocked the Cross Harbour Tunnel, a major road into the city. In response, the Hong Kong police force laid siege on the university, using tear gas, water cannons, and non-lethal rounds to prevent students from escaping. Despite protesters' efforts, which included throwing bricks and petrol bombs at the police, the campus was overtaken on November 29th with approximately 1,300 arrests. On November 18th, the second day of the siege, police took a less violent tactic to try and break the occupation. They broadcasted Auld Lang Syne on loudspeakers around the campus. Photojournalist Locke Lee, who was in Hong Kong Polytechnic University during the occupation, took this recording. While not a live performance, the use of a bagpipe recording of Auld Lang Syne against besieged protesters highlights the stark changes that have occurred in Hong Kong since 1997. In February 2019, the Hong Kong government proposed an amendment to the existing fugitive extradition law, allowing for extradition from countries without a formal extradition treaty. Critics feared that this amendment would make it easier for mainland China to silence political dissent and would lead to a further erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy. In practice, the CCP has selected every preferred chief executive beginning in 1997. The elections were conducted by appointed selection committees, and everyone knew which candidates were the chosen ones. The basic law dictated that the chief executive would eventually be elected through universal suffrage. The reforms proposed in the 2010s assured that direct elections would be postponed indefinitely. This led to the Umbrella Revolution, a 77-day occupation of major Hong Kong intersections and calls for democratic reforms. These calls would ultimately go unanswered, and the arrests of three prominent pro-democracy activists in 2017 would further dissent. The months-long protests against the 2019 bill were in many ways a culmination of this simmering unrest. Even after Chief Executive Carrie Lam withdrew the bill in September 2019, protests continued. Many of the continued grievances of protesters revolved around the police, who classified the protests as riots and were accused of excessive brutality. From 1997 until 2011, the Hong Kong police force had an approval rating of between 50 and 75%, but this plummeted to 21% during the 2014 protests and never recovered. The police represented a very different entity to Hong Kongers in 2019 than they did in 1997, a source of fear and instability instead of security. With this political context in mind, let's now return to the recording. There are limitless songs that the police could have used for their counter-protest action, but they specifically chose a bagpipe version of Auld Lang Syne. While I doubt broadcasting this song at besieged protesters was an intentional reference to the handover ceremony, this recording does seem to draw stark contrast with the 1997 performance. Crucially, the audience of the handover ceremony were there by choice and were moved, likely due to the song's familiarity and emotional solidarity, to sing along. In contrast, the 2019 protesters were forced to listen to this song with no escape. In the recording, there is no participation, no musical response, or even acknowledgement from the protesters. They do not embrace the song like how the 1997 audience did. In this sense, the song is more of a demonstration of police might than a reflection of public uncertainty and hope for the future. It is an effort to control the protesters and force them into submission. The colonial and military implications of the bagpipe are no longer hidden under a mask of political neutrality. Instead, it is an explicit reminder of the relationship between bagpipe music and the Hong Kong police. For both protesters and the police, bagpipe music likely was seen as a way to force order into a politically turbulent situation. While it is a stability of a different kind than in 1997, it speaks to the same impulse. However, in contrast, the audience of this bagpipe performance don't want this stability. They see it as dangerous and coercive, a symbol of state power. These dimensions to the bagpipe were always there. They've just come to the fore with this performance. I don't think this is a bell that can ever be unrung. This performance altered the conditions of possibility for the bagpipe in Hong Kong, making it a constant reminder that its existence is political. I want to conclude where I began, with the most recent New Year's Eve performance of Auld Lang Syne by the Hong Kong Police Pipe Band. This performance took place at Victoria Harbour as part of the city's larger New Year's Eve celebration. In a purported break from past years, this performance was apparently not broadcast on television. As a result, its existence is only evidenced through videos taken by attendees. The start of the new year begets complex emotions. It is a time of new beginnings, fresh starts, and hope for better things to come. But it is also a time to reflect on what was lost throughout the year: opportunities, relationships, loved ones, and time itself. In Hong Kong, this loss has been its autonomy, In 2020, a national security law was passed that essentially ended the one country, two systems framework in Hong Kong, criminalizing many forms of protest and dissent as sedition. Many independent news organizations, such as Apple Daily, have permanently shuttered. Dozens of activists and protesters from the 2019 anti-extradition bill protests have been arrested and faced decades in prison. Despite pro-democracy candidates gaining a vast majority in Hong Kong's Legislative Council in 2019, arrests and an electoral overhaul to exclude those not considered patriots has resulted in the current legislature being primarily pro-Beijing. From a musical perspective, decolonization efforts have led to the removal of many Scottish folk songs from the Hong Kong Police Pipe Band's repertoire, Auld Lang Syne notwithstanding. What allowed this song to survive? Likely tradition. As MJ Grant writes, the categories of folk and tradition often seem ideologically neutral, even though they are deeply politicized. The tradition of pipe bands playing Auld Lang Syne at midnight on New Year's is a worldwide ritual. This annual performance may be a way for the government to signal normalcy, that things will be business as usual, despite its concentrated efforts to strip Hong Kongers of their rights. Once again, the bagpipe has become a symbol of neutrality. And, as before, it masks a forceful coercion to ensure stability. In Andrew Yu's research on the impacts of the national security law on bagpiping in Hong Kong, he interviewed many pipers who did not want bagpipe music to be considered political. I understand where this impulse comes from. It's a desire to have the bagpipe survive as a constant, stable reference in the midst of political change and unrest. But I can't help but think that this is an ideal that only a privileged few can aspire to achieve. For the 69-year-old busker, who was arrested in 2023 for playing Glory to Hong Kong on the Aru, and was charged with four counts of playing a musical instrument in public without a permit, can the instrument and the politics be so easily disentangled? For the students and protesters forced to listen to Auld Lang Syne when trapped in Poly U, does the New Year's Eve performance still seem like an apolitical event? I don't have answers to these questions, but I bring them up to highlight the recursive nature of musical behavior and experience on the habitus of listening and musical material affordances. In Hong Kong, a desire for stability has underpinned the continued use of the bagpipe in important political and cultural contexts. What exactly this stability is and who is aspiring to create it has fluctuated over time, but it is an impulse reflected not just in the bagpipe's historical role, but also in its physical construction. The bagpipe also illustrates how claims of its political neutrality are in and of themselves fraught with questions of privilege, dominion, and control. The future of the Great Highland Bagpipe in Hong Kong is uncertain, as many of the traditions accompanying its performance have disappeared as a result of the government's decolonization efforts. But I suspect that the instrument's attunement towards stability will give it a bit more longevity. I would like to thank my peer reviewers, Larry Whitsley-Benn and Jennifer Weaver, for their insightful feedback on this project. I would also like to thank my team lead, John Heilig, and my audio producer, Jose Garza, for their support. A massive thank you to Anna Yu Wong for encouraging me to submit my work to SMT Pod, and to my advisor, Gavin Steingo, for all of his invaluable advice and support. Thank you all so much.
Visit our website, smtpod.org, for supplemental materials related to this episode and to learn how to submit an episode proposal. And join in the conversation by tweeting us your questions and comments at @smt_pod. SMT Pod's theme music was written by Maria Tartaglia, with closing music by Ika Jong.